Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the Voice of the Millennials. One of the topics that I've been speaking about recently and thinking about quite a bit is decolonization and with regards to the South African Muslim experience. Now, just this week, I facilitated a discussion on the racial tendencies within the Muslim community in South Africa and how we need to decolonize that, how we need to, you know, diagnose it and treat it. It was quite a good turnout. It was a wonderful discussion that we had with Mona Yasin Katona, Mona Fidel Jones, Professor Shahid Voda from UCT, and Insaf Isaacs. Now, looking at decolonization of our own history and the perception of who we are as Muslims in South Africa, I speak now to historian Dr. Halim Ginchoglu, who has been in South Africa for more than 10 years now, looking at the various histories connecting the Ottoman Empire, or particularly Turkey, to the South African Muslim history in the person of Sheikh Abu Bakr Effendi, rahimahullah. And he recently gave a talk on decolonizing the archive from an Afro-Asian perspective based on his research. Assalamu alaikum, Dr. Halim.
Alaikum salam, Yasin.
So the talk was, I heard, was very, very good. Tell us about what you mean by the Afro-Asian perspective on the archives.
Shukran, Yasin. I am a research fellow, postdoctoral research fellow in Afro-Asian studies at University of Cape Town. Also, I am teaching in African studies. We mentioned that Afro-Asian studies. Afro-Asian perspective is bringing another dimension to the historiography, South African history, and how it brings that dimension. Firstly, the Ottoman archives and other Asian archives as well, for instance, I mean Iranian, Persian archives. What we know about Persian archives in what Persian archives tell us about Africa. Unfortunately, these archives has been neglected for years and years. And on the other side, we are only looking at Western archives for African studies, which is very problematic. In my studies, I try to bring another alternative source data for African studies, and this seminar, which was just took in African Studies Gallery on the 1st of August, basically yesterday. And it's called Mafiji Jordan Seminar Series, and I just opened the series with my talk. And Professor Wawda, Shahid Wawda, actually he's holding the he's head of the Africa School of Africa. What I did in my talk, I try to show one. On the one hand, when we are talking about Cecil Rhodes, yes, Cecil Rhodes, Smuts, or Hofmeyrs, they were colonizers. However, what else we know about them? I mean, what other archives, especially Asian archives, what those archives telling us about them? And because even they are colonizers or not, we have to really know and we have to examine their legacy in the context of decolonization. And that would make our studies much meaningful. And even these fee must fall and roads must fall kind of movements, those movements will be also analyzed much in much wider context. For instance, when Cecil Rhodes colonized Southern Africa, when he met South Africa, a British colony, what Turkish Empire did? That we can take that this from here, this question. Sultan Abdülhamid, he was aware of all these things, and one of his commanders in Cairo, Ahmet Muhtar Pasha, he informed Istanbul government, and he said that, I translated this document from Ottoman language to English, and it says that Ahmet Muhtar Pasha said that the British Empire, after the occupation of Egypt, British Empire tried to occupy Sudan, and they also established a railway station from Cap to Cairo. So railway station was in Suakin in Sudan. So he was telling Istanbul government that you must send some artilleries to Suakin to protect the region. Otherwise, region is going to be occupied by British Empire. And there are many others documents about Southern Africa in Turkish archives. That makes it much meaningful when we compare these things.
Okay, so just on a practical level, when we talk about decolonization, your suggestion is to use more Afro-Asian resources when we look at our own history compared to what we've been using, which has been mostly Western sources. And right. A large part of that is because when the Dutch and the British were they were ruling, you know, during colonialism, were ruling the Cape Colony, they had written journals and they had written right. back to the ruling states, of course, being right. Netherlands and being England, and they were largely part of these companies who did the Dutch East Indian Company, etc., which was the major feature of new empires, you know, with the improved technologies. But when it comes to African sources itself, why do we need to look at Turkish sources and other sources about Africa itself? Yeah. Is there not enough African sources?
Good question, and there are two answers for this question. One of them is, yes, it's limited archival source we have in South Africa. I've been working on studying on CAP Archive, South African National Archive, for years and years. There are many important documents here, and even about Turkey and relationship between Turkey and South Africa, but definitely limited. But another thing, we must remember that South African documents, I mean, from National Archive, written by Western colonizers, I mean, you can't also trust them. I give you one example. Death certificate of Ebu Bekir Efendi, if you look at that, you see there his occupation, Malay priest. First, he wasn't Malay. Mm. Second, he wasn't priest.
Yes.
He was imam. He was imam, but he was a scholar. He was a professor of theology. He wasn't, of course, Malay, but they put him in they gave him another identity in South Africa. He is Muslim, he is Malay. Automatically he became something else. Doesn't matter, we are not dealing here with, you know, his ethnic identity, Malay or Turkish or whatever, but we just look at their, how they are, you know, disrespectful to his identity. They don't care about it. That another thing, in his the year he died, they say his age was about 57. If you look at the death certificate, it can't be about 57. It's 57 or not. You know, no, we must look at it as, I mean,
yes,
there must be proper information. In fact, if they had a bit effort and go to ask their families, they would see that. They would see Ebu Bekir Efendi's passport. Mm-hmm. It's written there, actually, his birthday dates and everything clear, but they didn't worry about it. They just, colonizers, I mean, Cape Colony at that time, they did whatever is just, you know, easy for them. So in this regard, we can't trust these kind of archives. We use them critically. We critique these documents. And of course, another dimension, I mean, if you compare it with other sources, like Turkish source, or even, for instance, next month I am going to give another talk at UCT is about Ottoman army in Indian Ocean in 16th century. But Ottoman Navy, naval force, was always challenging with Portuguese Navy. So I also checked Portuguese source. I don't only look at Turkish source, and of course English source. And that makes it much meaningful. Then you see what Portuguese say about this, and what English people say about that. So that's what I'm trying to say in my study.
So as a historian, how do you verify whether an event is factual or not? You know, how do you make 100% sure or certain that something had occurred in a certain way?
In social science, you cannot be sure 100%, firstly. We must know that. We are not working on, you know, numbers like maths. No, it's not like that. But what we are doing, there are particular methodology for historical studies. You firstly use primary source. You look what is primary source? Of course, archival source. And sometimes oral history is also, verbal information is also important. It corrects one another. And other documents, documented, so of course, analysis is very important, correct analysis. From one document, we cannot get the result. We cannot get decision about the subject. So, firstly, primary source must be taken into consideration. And then we follow other source. We take them into consideration. We deal with many other documents in the field, not just historical source. For instance, in historical studies, I look at, sometimes I use map, cartography. It's another important source for us. When we are talking about certain region, we have to know really what they mentioned in those days, let's say if it's 16th century we are talking about, what 16th century map telling us, or epigraphy, another field, we are looking at, even gravestones are source for us. I mean, I was writing about Ismail Jobert, very famous poet, and Tatamkulu Afrika.
Yes, yes.
I look at his poems, and then I just suddenly ask myself, where this man lived and died? I mean, what really affected him? And he wrote very interesting poets. I find his grave also in Etlon. I look at his. That's how you are getting close to his legacy. That's very important to understand him. I mean, you have to know where he lived and what was conditions he dealt, you know, in his life. So then you understand this kind of circumstances, he wrote these kind of stories and sad stories sometimes.
That's interesting. I mean, there is this whole movement within humanities, and I think a lot of young people are also drawn towards it, is that you can never interpret someone else's experiences better than they themselves can. You know, in a way that's their lived experience. So when it comes to any social trend when it comes to the Me Too movement, for example, where all of these women were sexually abused, you have to give them a hearing so they can speak for themselves.
Right.
But then when it comes to you as a historian having to listen to all of these different people, you know, in your research of Sheikh Bakr Effendi, for example, all of the different people you have to meet and talk to and listen to, what's the benefit of preserving that history as an outsider then?
From the people, you cannot get really proper information. You, if you are a historian, you can get, but if you are just a person who has that interest for the particular studies or leaders, you are going to make big mistake. I mean, that's why when I talk to some people, they tell me a lot of different stories are. They are, they have lots of, they're misleading, of course. But if you are, if you know how to study these things as historian, if you know this field, and you more or less understand what, for instance, I give you an example again. One of the great grandson of Ebu Bekir Efendi, I met him and I talked to him. He told me Ebu Bekir Efendi was sent to South Africa by Enver Pasha. He heard this Enver Pasha somewhere, but he didn't know even. Enver Pasha was born before Ebu Bekir Efendi came to South Africa. In fact, he meant Ahmet Cevdet Pasha. Mm. Ahmet Cevdet Pasha, he sent Ebu Bekir Efendi to Southern Africa. So, if you know, you know who is Enver Pasha, you just immediately say that, okay, this man talks nonsense now. Yeah, I mean, but Pasha, that side is right, Pasha, the general, military general, Pasha means. So, even family members make lots of mistakes, because, of course, Ebu Bekir Efendi died 138 years ago, you know, it's you know, big gap between our new generation and death of Ebu Bekir Efendi.
Yeah. Now, one of the other things as well that I've noticed about Western archives and Western sources, whenever they interpret traditional sources as well, whenever we talk about spirituality, and this is a major aspect of the Afro-Asian tradition, a lot of what is spoken about is symbolic for spiritual realities that they experience, whether it's religiously or whether it's to do with their tradition and their cultures. How do you look at that when you see, certain, practices done in the Muslim community, for example, that's spiritual? How do you approach that from a historical perspective?
We have to take them into consideration as well, even if we don't believe that. For instance, if we talk about Ratip ceremony in 19th century, you do believe it or not, it was a reality in the community. And we are looking at particular, firstly we look at, of course, origin of Ratip ceremony, where it comes from originally, Indonesia or Egypt or Iran, doesn't matter, I mean, where it comes from, but it does matter when you write about it, because then you know which, that, as you said, spirituality it contains, you know. So that's important, of course. That's why when someone also write about history of Turkey from South Africa or from England, they make mistake, because they don't know that spirituality and, you know, details about particular things in Turkey, tradition, customs, lifestyles, different identities. It applies to all other studies as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, that's quite interesting. So, since it's Women's Month in South Africa, I wanted to perhaps also ask you about the role that women have played historically in your studies. I don't know, perhaps in the Muslim community. You mentioned previously that Sheikh Bakr Effendi had started a madrasa where there were predominantly women coming to this madrasa. Right. Tell us about that, since it's women's month.
Yeah, thank you very much for the question. That's a very important question, because we always neglect women, especially if the subject is about Islam or Islamic history. Definitely, Abu Bakr Efendi played crucial role in shaping of the Islamic culture in South Africa, and women took important place in his life. He taught many students, many women. He established the first Muslim girls' school in Beit Inqara Street. He taught his own wife, Tahora Saban. Tahora became the first teacher of that school. I find actually recently Tahora's school program. Tahora's great granddaughter sent it to me from Port Elizabeth, David Baker Efendi. It was written in 1872. You can see that these are all historical sources. We have to keep them and show them to our students also. I find them, it's very inspirational. Yeah. Because imagine in 19th century, a Muslim woman, she is white, she has white skin, proper English girl, but she converted to Islam, and she didn't care about that, you know, the class, social class, what she has. She was happy about being Muslim, and she lived and died like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a big sacrifice. Tahora Saban is a very important person in the history of South Africa. Unfortunately, they are forgotten figures. Abu Bakr Efendi's other son, the first, actually, eldest son, Ahmet Ataullah Efendi, his wife was Muhsine Abdurrahman, Dr. Abdullah Abdurrahman's wife. Hmm. She is the first person, Muhsine Abdurrahman. She became also a school principal in, I have the photo, it's here, school principal in at this Islamic school, Ottoman Imperial School, they call it like that, in Kimberley. Muhsine Abdurrahman, Muhsine Abdurrahman had four children. Look how they are important. One of them, two of them were boys, and two they were girls. Hatice and the other one is Hawa Irinisa. Hawa Irinisa became first medical doctor. First Muslim woman medical doctor in South Africa. Muslim female medical doctor in South Africa. And she lived and died in, she was born in Kimberley and she died in Johannesburg. And her sister Hatice, she got married with Yakup Hasan, well-known Indian Muslim from Johannesburg. And I have his photo also, and he was close friend of Mahatma Gandhi. They live in Johannesburg, but then they moved to Karachi. And Hatice became, she was anyway, but in Karachi she worked, she did in her work on her studies. She became the first medical, first judge in Karachi, female judge.
Wow.
Yeah, and I have her photo as well. These are important people, I mean, in especially Dr. Hawa Hayrunnisa. She stayed in South Africa. She was born here, and her mother was Dr. Abdullah Abdurrahman's sister.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, they really contributed to woman, especially independence of woman or liberation of woman, especially Muslim woman in South Africa. So we have to acknowledge these people.
Now, just finally, when it comes to history as a subject at university for any young people to study, that might be listening, whether they're in high school or starting university, and in terms of history as a career, what is your advice regarding that? And then I do have another question with regards to what aspects of the Cape Muslim or South African Muslim you see that you've looked at still needs to be looked at further, that perhaps by yourself or by people to still to come.
Oh, thank you. I will respond to answer your second question from I start from second one. I would love to someone study on what actually Ahmed Davids left, because that site is a big gap, and Ahmed David did big contribution in this field. But unfortunately, after death of Ahmed David, there is no really much study after that. You know, nobody really show proper interest on that. Or in that detail, I haven't seen anything like that. You might like him or you might like his study or not, it's not the matter. As I said, we are historians, we talk professionally. Ahmed David, for me, I mean, as his Turkish historian, Ahmed David, if he didn't write such lot, we couldn't come this stage.
It's amazing that you say so, because it was Dr. Ahmed Davids who himself said a lot of things or wrote a lot of things about Sheikh Abu Bakr Effendi, which you've now come to, in your own words, rectify and show that it wasn't correct. But
I do.
It's great that you at least acknowledge the work of Dr. Ahmed Davids.
I do, of course I do, because when we are not, I just tell my students, we are not writing on Facebook, we are writing on proper studies. Yes. Some of my papers published in Harvard, in very credited journal in Turkey or South Africa. Ahmed David, he was the first man really proper study on these things. And if you look at his last book, Africans of Cape Muslims, that book is very important source actually. People must, especially students, young historians, history students, they must look at that book and they must continue from that study. Unfortunately, I am not fluent in Afrikaans, and especially Arabic Afrikaans is something else. You know, they can do this because their mother language, some of them's mother language Afrikaans.
Yes, of course.
So I donated the manuscript, a copy of manuscripts to Jagger Library at UCT and many other sources as well. They can go and study on that manuscripts. Ebu Bekir Efendi's handwritten, Beyanuddin. They can read properly and understand. And
is that in Netherlands, right?
No, I'm talking about manuscript.
We are those manuscripts in the Netherlands.
No. The manuscripts
in South Africa.
Ebu Bekir Efendi's grandchildren. Copies.
Yes.
I copied and I donated to UCT because, that's how knowledge, it become, we create knowledge, you know. If you work on it proper, that's how Ahmed David did anyway.
Yeah.
Of course, I criticized Ahmed David in my studies sometimes because it's, of course, academically, otherwise I have respect for him. I did because I have to rectify what he did, what was his mistakes. For instance, he got confused about two Efendis. He completely forget about other Efendis, Efendi family who lived in Bukhap Museum. It was 71 Wales Street, became Bukhap Museum much later. So Of course, he made mistake because he was he didn't know Turkish source and he couldn't differentiate from each other. Mm-hmm. That's understandable. I didn't criticize him. I just corrected what he did, his mistakes. Or other thing he said, Ebu Bekir Efendi's son vanished in history, for instance. Mm-hmm. Actually, he's talking about Ahmet Ataullah Efendi. He went to Singapore. He became Ottoman Consul General in Singapore. So these are normally, we all make mistakes. I mean, but I still say that Ahmet David, if students, South African Muslim students, especially history students, if you want to study, that site is a big gap there still.
So how does someone, you know, get access to that?
In 8th of September, I donate my archives to my Turk. I translated them to English. I will donate them to UCT archive, Jagger Library, and in 9th of September we are going kind of celebration exhibition there, and they can also access my archives there, archival source, and they will just start how we are restarted, you know, like Ahmet David did, you know. That's from firstly they have to read who Ahmet David studies, mosques of book up, especially very important book still, and they can also read my studies and others.
Yes, well, I mean, Ahmet David has written, you know, a number of books, the Mosques of Buka, Social History, Afrikaans of the Cape Muslims, yeah. Pages from Cape Muslim History, yes. The History of the Tanabaru, and Preschool Education. He was, of course,
about Tanabaru, Yasin, sorry to interrupt, but sure. That's another important thing. Tanabaru Cemetery is not just a cemetery, it's a big heritage for us, very important land, holy land for us. What I want to do, or what also we have to do, we cannot leave it to only Tanabaru Trust. They have limited finance to look after the land, you know, the graveyard. So we have to also help them. How? As community, I am talking about. My idea, university. And not just in South Africa. I mean, I can convince my university, I mean, in African studies, because Tanabaru Cemetery is the oldest cemetery in South Africa, oldest Muslim cemetery in South Africa.
Yes.
And if you go inside, you know, it's difficult to even find where Ebu Bekir Efendi's grave is. After I renovated, yes, it looks well, but you must... When you go in from just entrance, you must turn left and you go up. You can't properly see that.
Yeah, you have to walk right up.
Huh. What we can do, and proper architects and, especially land architects, they must work on the graveyard properly. And I can even arrange another university in Turkey. We can work together. You know, could be collaborative work. So to make that graveyard like proper, like heritage. Everybody can. It's his history.
Well, I mean, in the same way that Said Alawi is buried in a, you know, building,
yeah.
It's marked, and of course Tuanguru kind of as well, even though the structure wasn't able to complete.
Yeah.
You propose that something similar.
We don't
is
need
done.
To build anything. We just need to take everything out nicely, clean. Like archaeologists must come and help us, especially archaeologists. They of course some imams will also accompany us because they can read Arabic Afrikaans. I read Arabic, but I can't understand because I only understand Bismillahirrahmanirrahim or Huwal Baki, you know, but you don't understand what the text say, Afrikaans, yeah. So there are some imams sitting in Bukhab, like Sheikh Shirat Johar, they read very fluent Arabic Afrikaans. they can help us, and archaeologists, we can make that graveyard like proper historical place. Many people show interest that historical land, you know, it's very important land. We have to, of course, Ebu Bekir Efendi is also buried there. He was buried there, but he's only one there, and there are many others. There are many gravestones underground there. We don't see them.
We don't know even who's buried there. As
exactly.
Well.
Maybe we will find some other important graveyard. Gravestones.
Mm-hmm.
When we read them, it will be. That's another historic. This is also part of historical studies.
Yeah.
I mean, you are looking at this. We call it epigraphy.
Yeah.
You know, you are looking at gravestones, other, you know, historical boards. But otherwise, you know, we don't know what is going on there, what's happening. So.
Okay, well, thank you so much for that insight. And it's always nice picking your brain, Dr. Halim Kinchoglu. Wish you all the best. And is there any way people can get in contact with you in case they want to talk to you, perhaps contribute to any of the suggestions that you had made this evening?
Yes, they can come to African Studies at UC. They find me there.
Okay.
Or if they Google my name, they can find my website or
email. Right?
Email, anything. Yeah, everything is available online.
What is your email?
They can use my university email, halim.gencoglu@uct.ac. That's it.
Okay, so Halim is spelled Halim. Kinchoglu is Gencoglu, right. Without any of the squiggles. Yeah, in normal Latin. Well, shukran so much to you and all the best.
Afwan Yasin, shukran, assalamu alaikum.